This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Coming up, we take a look at the plight of Pacific seafarers who haven't set foot on dry land for nearly a year in the face of the coronavirus pandemic. And after 14 years, Kenny Lassar has stepped down as editor of the Samoa Observer. We'll be asking him why and what shape he leaves his newspaper in. Hello, I'm Richard Ewart. Those stories to come a little later, but first to Papua New Guinea, where officials now believe 15 people, including three children, were killed in a landslide in a remote part of Central Province. Search and rescue teams have recovered two bodies so far, but their work has been hampered by heavy rain. The landslide early on Monday morning swept away a camp used by informal alluvial miners who panned for gold in the area. The scene of the disaster is extremely remote, and information about the scale of what happened is emerging still only slowly. Our Papua New Guinea correspondent Natalie Whiting is following developments and joins us now from Port Moresby. Nat, good morning to you.
Good morning, Richard.
Now, we were talking about 10 deaths potentially yesterday. That number has now risen to 15. I mean, it's beginning to look perhaps as if this incident was even bigger than first thought.
Unfortunately, it seems that way. We had the local MP, William Sarmb, and disaster officials fly out to the site. Mr. Sarmb is actually still out there, but we had some officials fly back yesterday. And once they were able to get on the ground in this remote area, speak to people and assess the situation, they were able to give us some more detail. And they now believe, yes, 15 people, including children, buried alive.
Now, pictures of the site have emerged. Effectively, it looks very much like a large chunk of hillside has just peeled away. I mean, how are those working at the scene finding the work, which essentially, I guess, is a recovery operation right now?
It's been incredibly difficult for the people that are there. A lot of the recovery work is being done by locals, from nearby camps and villages. They've come in to help, but they don't have proper equipment. You know, they're using shovels, pitchforks, sticks, whatever they can get their hands on to try to dig through this massive fallen earth and try to reach the bodies of the victims. And because of how remote it is, you know, you can only walk into this area or fly in via a chopper. It's very difficult to get supplies in to try to improve the recovery effort. They are bringing in some more shovels. They're bringing in chainsaws and axes to try to help. But between that and the rain they're continuing to get, it sounds like it's incredibly difficult.
And that you're in Port Moresby. I'm wondering, I mean, has this incident been generating wider publicity? What's been the reaction amongst the Papua New Guinean population more generally?
It has been. As we've said, obviously, it took a little while for details to come out because of this, the remoteness and the fact there's no mobile reception at the campsite. So it did take a little while. But one of the journalists for the national newspaper flew in with the member, so the national paper has had this on their front page, and it's being met with great sadness in PNG, and here in Port Moresby it's certainly being widely talked about. A lot of sympathy for these people who were trying to make a bit of money over this Christmas period.
And looking to the broader picture, you talked about people there trying to make a bit of money. I mean, do you think, though, that this incident is likely to generate government action, maybe further regulations to curb informal mining now in light of the risk that these people clearly were taking?
There's been no discussions of reforms to the sector at this stage. Obviously, the focus has been on just discovering the extent of what's happened and trying to recover the bodies. However, I did ask the MP, Mr. Sarmb, and the central governor, who's expected to fly in today. I did ask both of them about, the risks and does this speak to the issues that people face in the informal mining sector. That they both said it did, that, you know, that it highlighted it is a risky business. And this obviously isn't something that is just happening in Central Province. It's widespread, and this is one of only many issues that people face in the sector.
Natalie, we'll continue to follow developments. Thank you very much indeed for the update. That's Natalie Whiting, our PNG correspondent there, on the line from Port Moresby. You're with Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia on this New Year's Eve and on the eve of 2021. Australia is set to welcome the new year with rising coronavirus concerns in two states now. In New South Wales, an outbreak has spread across Sydney and onto Wollongong, while in Victoria, three new cases linked to New South Wales have been identified, the first in the Victorian community for around 2 months. As a result, as Annie Guest reports, there are calls for the return of tighter COVID-19 restrictions.
The number of people who've caught coronavirus in Australia's most populous state has gone from zero to 160 in a fortnight, sparking health alerts across hundreds of kilometres. There's now a new Sydney cluster, and after 2 months COVID-free, Victoria has three new cases, which authorities believe are linked to New South Wales. Stephen Parnas is a Melbourne emergency physician.
If cases from Sydney are now seeding into Melbourne, then to me that has the potential to become a disaster. It's an effort to suppress that frustration. And I know that I am not the only person who is aghast at the slow pace, the lack of resolution and a sense of complacency.
And another who's aghast is Bill Botell, an adjunct professor at UNSW's Kirby Institute for Infection and Immunity.
It's time now to have a proper lockdown in Sydney, to limit spread, to use masks, and certainly not to have such things as the SCG test going ahead.
The state government has left open the possibility of changes to next week's test after the new cluster emerged among three families from across Sydney who'd gathered over Christmas in Croydon in the Inner West. It's not linked to the cluster on the Northern Beaches, where residents remain locked down. For tonight, special passes are needed to enter Sydney's CBD, but pubs and bars are allowed to open for ticketed events. Outdoor gatherings are now reduced to 30 people and visitor numbers to 5 in homes in Sydney, the Blue Mountains, Wollongong and Central Coast.
The approach in New South Wales did not work, for example, in Victoria in the middle of the year, where they tried to lock down various parts of the city. But of course, the virus doesn't understand Australian postcodes. Was too late. It had spread across metropolitan Melbourne. Now, we certainly don't want that situation to replicate itself in New South Wales and in Sydney.
The Premier, Gladys Berejiklian, says more cases are expected, but the current measures are appropriate.
The health advice is still such that we have a handle on current outbreak. I mean, obviously the Croydon cluster is concerning because there is no established link. All the other cases, there is some crossover.
The approach is supported by Dr. Fiona Stanaway, a clinical epidemiologist at the University of Sydney.
It's good that they've increased restrictions further, and it's, you know, I'm still hopeful that that will be enough in containing this increase.
Some epidemiologists think it's time for a total lockdown across Sydney. What are your thoughts?
You know, lockdowns are very effective in controlling the virus, but they're not without harms as well. I guess the other thing as well is people need to get tested. That's the way that this approach that New South Wales is using of, you know, keeping things open to an extent, but just restricting the numbers at gatherings. That's really what that whole strategy is based on. If people aren't getting tested and we're just having those links missing, it stops the ability of us to control the spread of the virus.
And fewer people have turned up for testing over Christmas. Among those urging them to do so is Inner West councillor Marganina De Cruz, whose constituency includes the Croydon cluster.
Check the New South Wales government website because that's giving the latest update of the sites and where you should get tested. I think you do need to stay calm and also be sensible.
Meanwhile, in Victoria, the connection between the three latest cases from Mitcham, Mentone and Hallam is unclear. People who've been to venues visited by the women are urged to get tested.
That's Annie Guest reporting. Now, on a related theme, as the pandemic continues to sweep across the globe, it's been tough for many people. wanting to spend the holiday season with family and friends. But for the 400,000 seafarers stranded across the world, the very thought of returning home was simply out of the question. International border closures mean that seafarers, including many from the Pacific Islands, have been at sea for a period well beyond their 10-month contracts, and they have little or no idea on when they'll get back on dry land. The International Labour Organization is pushing the UN to recognize seafarers as key workers so member countries can allow crew exchanges to take place and some of those stranded to be repatriated at least. Seafarers who are not working after their contracts ran out are holed up in hotels in Australia, in New Zealand and Fiji, and in Europe and the United States, with shipping companies paying the bill. Here in Australia, the Mission to Seafarers has been helping those at sea and on land. Evan Wasuka has been speaking to the organisation's Regional Director for Australia and PNG, Reverend Gary Dodd.
For the seafarers who have been trapped on board, it actually highlights their isolation. They more than any other time of the year, they want to be with their families. They want to be able to just relax and share those gifts with their children and to be once again reunited. So for the seafarers, particularly during this COVID season, when they might even be in a port, they might even be in their own home port, but are unable to leave the vessel because of COVID restrictions. So it has meant that for tens of thousands of seafarers, they've just been denied the opportunity to celebrate this really important special time of the year.
A lot of the restrictions mean they can't actually leave their ships or move around. It's a particularly tough job to do at this time, isn't it?
It's heartbreaking to imagine what it would be like to work 24/7. And they sign up for it. They know what they're doing. They're sacrificing themselves so they can earn good money for their family, or at least some money for their family. But then when they can't get ashore, when the 12-month contract is up and they're stranded on board because of COVID, it just means that there's a sense of hopelessness. Like, when will they ever get home? And that's what's happening at the moment. And I guess as an organisation, what we're trying to do is bring home to them. We're trying to reunite them through digital means by getting Wi-Fi units on board vessels or allowing them to ring and chat to a chaplain or to somehow get them a data card so that they can ring their loved ones. They're the ways in which the Mission to Seafarers in the Pacific and Australia, New Zealand and right around the world has been trying to help seafarers be connected emotionally and spiritually, but importantly mentally, so that they can, you know, just endure the next 2, 3, 4, 6, 12 months. That nobody knows how long these guys will be stranded on board these vessels.
I imagine the mental toll on the seafarers who are working, who haven't been home. What have they been telling you, the ones you've interacted with?
Well, Evan, it's a bit like what I mentioned a moment ago. There's just no hope, because there's no light at the end of the tunnel. So as a seafarer, when you sign up, you might sign up for a 10-month contract or a 12-month contract. You know that contract might end 2 months early, or there may be a month or so extension because you're at anchor and can't get ashore or for some reason, you know. But because of COVID, they don't know when they're going to go home. I was talking to a seafarer just at Christmas time, and he was saying that, you know, he had arranged his contract so that he would be home for the birth of his son. Now, that was in March, and so he missed his son's very first Christmas and potentially will even miss his first birthday. So just hearing those stories of pain and anguish, it's just heartbreaking, because, you know, it's hard to give them hope when nobody knows when they'll be able to leave that vessel and finally be able to go home.
With COVID-19 shutting down international travel, the world has pretty much relied on international shipping to get things across. So their jobs are really important at this time. But do you feel that they're getting are they being treated properly? Should governments be doing more to help out seafarers in getting home?
Because it's not impossible, it's just hard and it's costly. So if there was a political will, there wouldn't be 400,000 seafarers that are currently stranded. And of course, the other side of that is that there's 400,000 seafarers who want to go and rejoin a vessel and earn money for their families. So governments really need to make the solutions work, because they know what to do, they're just not prepared to spend the money to do it. And of course, what's going to happen is as seafarers get further and further fatigued, as their mental health decline, there will be greater accidents. There will be vessels right around the world that will be having accidents and running aground, and seafarers sadly taking their life because that they just can't cope anymore. And it will be at that point that governments will start to think about how they might help these seafarers that are just at the end of their line.
While we rely on seafarers, there's also this, unease. We've seen cases where COVID-19 has come through cargo ships and through crew. Has that sort of put them in a bad light as well, seafarers?
The international seafarers are a different class of seafarers. And, you know, we're talking about these vessels which have limited crew. You know, if there were cases of COVID, they could be contained and managed. So the incidences where this has happened around the world, they're few and far between. And we've learnt from those mistakes. Governments are just so anxious and of course seafarers are invisible. Nobody really thinks about their needs. All we want is what's on their vessel, whether it be medical supplies or at the latest gadget. We don't actually think about the humans that bring them to us. So governments could be fixing this problem. They're just choosing not to.
Reverend Gary Dodd, who's Regional Director in Australia and PNG for the Mission to Seafarers. He was speaking there to Evan Wasuka.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
We'll have the New Year's Eve weather details for you coming up shortly, plus one or two other news stories from near and far in Newswrap. But first, some music from Junior Raz in Vanuatu. It's a big deal, bad boy sound.
Comme Nayoware, les Fatoro et Crosso Thème. Aujourd'hui, il y a les bandes comme Moté, Bruxelles, Crosso Thème. Les big producers commencent à sentir avec le Dark System. Les DJs comme Mikwali, c'est top to the stem. Les gars, comme Clutchy et Milly, top friend. Right now, I like comme des bonnes, Babylon. Yo,
bring back bon vibes. Bon vibes out of Vanuatu, courtesy of Junior Raz. See if there are going to be bon vibes weather-wise in Vanuatu and around the rest of the Pacific as we check in at the Nandraki Weather Service with the director, Neville Coop. Neville, good morning to you.
Hi, good morning, Richard.
So last day of the year, what's the weather looking like?
Yeah, it's pretty much a carbon copy of yesterday insofar as it's pretty hot and steamy over most parts of the Pacific. All of the cloud and anything being weather is confined basically to the southern part of the tropics at the moment, along the equator and down through the atolls of Tuvalu and Tokelau. It's been fine and dry and sunny for a prolonged period of time now, and it's very much a feature of La Nina that's at its peak at the moment. We did talk a little bit about that yesterday, so no change to that, and that'll continue into the new year for a month or more to come, I think. But there is still some weather around Fiji, Tonga, and down into the Southern Cooks. Just some afternoon thundery showers, and also around Vanuatu and New Caledonia. A bit of the same up through the Solomons and about the Eastern Islands regions of Papua New Guinea, the mainland, which actually looks pretty good at the moment this morning. And so fairly decent sort of weather. Nothing's going to give us any surprises, no hazardous weather on the horizon at this stage, and we should ease gently into the new year.
Okay, well, Neville, we'll take this opportunity to thank you for providing us with weather details throughout the year, and Happy New Year to you and everyone else involved at the Nandraki Weather Service. Look forward to speaking to you in 2021.
Thanks, Richard, and likewise to everyone at the ABC and to all our listeners around the Pacific.
Okay, thanks again. That's Neville Coop there, Director of the Nandraki Weather Service. So relatively calm around the Pacific at the moment, which is just as well. Of course, 2 weeks after that awful cyclone hit Fiji. But unfortunately, we know there's likely to be another one at some point in the new year. But fingers crossed, maybe for once they'll leave us alone. And holding the front page for us on Pacific Pete this morning with our news wrap section, here's Nick Fogarty. Nick, good morning to you.
Morning, Richard.
So we were talking a little earlier in the week about Marshall Islands on the brink at that point of receiving their first shipment of COVID-19 vaccine. And I think we can confirm that the vaccine has indeed arrived and the vaccination program has begun.
Yes, so the Marshall's first round of vaccinations is now in full swing after an initial batch of 1,200 doses arrived on Tuesday morning, and they were in people's arms by that same afternoon. And we've actually seen some images of some high-ranking leaders there receiving the vaccine, including the High Court Chief Justice, the Chairman of the Council of Chiefs and the Health Minister, who were among the first to get it, along with frontline doctors and nurses. The Marshals will get another 6,000 doses of the Moderna vaccine from the US government in January, and they'll hope to have their 55,000-strong population fully vaccinated in the months after that. The news on the COVID-19 front hasn't been so good out of Fiji, as authorities there have confirmed another 3 cases right after lifting a suspension on inbound passenger flights. All of those cases are overseas arrivals who are now in border quarantine, and that takes Fiji's total cases to 49 since March.
Now to Papua New Guinea, and the Prime Minister, James Marape, of course, surviving into 2021 after he was threatened at least with a vote of no confidence towards the end of the year. And he's ending this year with a mission statement for the country and his New Year message. So what's he saying exactly?
Yes, so in the message of seasonal Christian greetings to Papua New Guineans, Mr. Marape has gone into great detail on what he sees as his government's achievements and reforms, particularly in the economy and social services area. To pull out a couple of the strands from his message, the Prime Minister says he intends to work with the Bougainville government to fully empower them in between their efforts to find a full political settlement. He wants to institutionalise an independent commission against corruption and implement a Whistleblowers Act, reform the Ombudsman Commission and modernise the police. Describing the underlying theme of his government, Mr. Marape says they took a hard reformist journey that was not going to be easy for the faint-hearted and pessimist. And as you mentioned, all this comes, of course, just a few weeks after James Marape survived that drawn-out challenge to his leadership.
Yeah, I suspect that may return in some other guise in the new year, but we'll leave that for now. Now, finally, the transport and food delivery giant Uber, been involved in something of a court tussle in the Australian Federal Court, could have had a significant outcome for Uber, but didn't play out that way.
That's right. So this did have the potential to set a very significant precedent for certain gig economy workers here in Australia, and it could have resulted in Uber and similar companies having to pay their workers a minimum wage, comply with unfair dismissal rules, and to roster employees properly. However, as things panned out, that legal precedent was not set because the case ended up being settled after the hearing. It concerned an Uber Eats worker named Amita Gupta, who was backed by the Transport Workers Union, and she claimed she'd been unfairly dismissed when her access to the company's systems was shut off because of late deliveries. In the hearing, the judges slammed many of Uber's claims, suggesting they weren't operating in the real world and that the court was not a debating club. So we'll be watching with interest to see if another similar case down the track does manage to set that precedent for workers.
Nick, thanks very much indeed. Nick Fogarty there with a news wrap here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Very shortly, we'll be talking to the now former editor of the Samoa Observer. Kenny Lassar has decided to step down from that role after 14 years. But first, some more music out of New Zealand.
Put you down in that place.
Jarry Reggae from the 1980s. Herbs with a track called Jarry Reggae with Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. And next up, one of the stalwarts of Pacific journalism has taken a step back from the daily news grind. Mata'afa Kanilasaa has vacated the editor's chair at the Samoa Observer, which he had occupied since May 2006. During that time, he steered the newspaper's coverage through some historic moments for the country, including the 2009 tsunami and the measles epidemic of 2019. Kenny's always been willing to talk to us here on Pacific Beat about what's going on in his neck of the woods, but this time the focus is on him as he joins us once again now from Apia. Kenny, good morning. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Good morning, Richard. Good morning to all your listeners and Tara Falava.
So tell me, why have you decided that now is the time to go?
Listen, you know, I've been doing this job for nearly 15 years as the editor, of course. You know, I think I've done my bit. Then it's time for the Samoa Observer to have some new launches and some new faces to take it to the next level. You know, I came through a time where, you know, guys like Xavier Sanomalifa and Peter Lomas, Richard Hunter, those were my mentor back in those days. And, you know, it's been a while. So, you know, I think it's time for me to step back and, you know, do some other things that are good in life.
So how would you describe the situation that you're now in? I mean, is this retirement? Are you just taking a break? I mean, how do you see the future mapping out for you now? Are you looking to stay in journalism or do something else?
Yeah, look, writing is obviously will be part of it's part of our DNA. So, you know, wherever it is going from here, you know, it will involve writing. It's definitely not retirement. I think I've still got a few good years to offer in whatever the next path takes me. So, you know, I'm just excited for the next steps.
So tell me then, when you reflect on, as you say, nearly 15 years as editor of The Observer, how do you see the paper that you're leaving? What shape is the paper in as compared to when you took it over?
Oh, look, the paper's in great shape now. They've got a great team of, you know, people. Obviously, we've got guys from overseas. We've got guys from Papua New Guinea and also Australia helping out with the transition. I think the biggest transition we've had to do is adapting to the online, you know, development, and that has been a massive part of, you know, developing the paper over the past few years. And I'm glad to say now that the paper is, you know, it's just as good as any other paper in the world, if not better.
Now, over the time that you've been doing the job as number one, I'm thinking it's got harder, hasn't it? And it's got harder for one particular reason, is that the government has made it difficult to report in the way I suspect you would wish your team to report.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's quite ironic, especially in Samoa, because I think our press freedom ranking is quite high compared to other countries. But this is the challenge, and I've said this time and time again. You know, we live in a very interesting community, and especially in Samoa, where we live in a one-party state. We have a very unique kind of democracy where, you know, there's this image out there of Samoa being really free and all that. But when it comes to reporting, it's actually very, very difficult, and the government does make it very difficult for journalists to do their work.
And, of course, one constant whilst you've been editor, the Prime Minister throughout has been, the Prime Minister has been Prime Minister for a long time, Tuilaepa. But, I mean, what's the relationship been like between you and him? Has it changed over the last 14, 15 years?
I'm not sure about that. Look, at the end of the day, he had a job to do and I had a job to do. And, you know, if I see him on the streets, I'll still say hello. I mean, if he wants to say hello to me, that is. But that, you know, over the years, nothing has really changed. You know, but the one thing I can tell you about Samoa is, you know, we're very respectable people in that way. You know, when it comes time to do our jobs, we do our jobs. But like when we meet up, you know, it's all good and fine. But you know, the Prime Minister as well has been in position for a long time, and you know, 22 years in the chair. I feel old doing that job for 22 years. So imagine being the Prime Minister for that long.
Do you get the sense, though, that as you vacate the editor's chair at The Observer, that you could be leaving at a point where maybe the one-party state is about to end and maybe there might be a change in prime ministership next year? Because the opposition seem to be galvanising themselves in a way perhaps they haven't done in the recent past in Samoa.
Oh, absolutely. And I say this because if you look at history and if you look at what's happened around the world, whatever powerful government has existed, you know, there's always a beginning and there's always an end. And so for me, When I stepped away from that chair yesterday, you know, I see that change is coming. It's it might not happen as much as some people want for the next election, but, you know, this is the beginning of something special for Samoa, something that a lot of people have been yearning for a long time. You know, the government has done a great job. They've done that. But you cannot have a government rule over a country this long and with this much power.
Now, you are, of course, a great sport lover, as I believe just about everybody in Samoa is, particularly where it comes to the rugby team, the Manu, of course, and the Sevens team. I'm just wondering what hope you have for rugby in Samoa to rise again, say, to the dizzy heights of 2010 when the Sevens side won the World Series.
You know what, to be quite honest with you, there's at the moment, really from where I stand and what people see on the ground, there's not much hope. You know, the COVID-19 has definitely not helped because, you know, while we have a new coach coming on board in the form of Fasi Lalamapusua, we you know, he's been hamstrung and all the developments have been hamstrung. So until we get over COVID-19, there's really not much to look forward to. But in terms of getting Samoan rugby back to where it was back in, you know, in the glory days, I really think a change is really, really necessary. I think you need to get rid of all those politics who are involved in running rugby and get some business people in there who have the right mind to run rugby and bring it up to, you know, to where it should be. Because we always know, and you know, people notice from the successes of the other teams that quite often, you know, wins and victories on the rugby field are achieved in the boardroom.
Question without notice, and I mentioned in the introduction big stories like the tsunami in 2009, the measles epidemic last year. Clearly you were right at the heart of the paper's coverage of those. But is there a story that maybe stands out for you which is a little bit away from the mainstream, one that meant a lot to you for a particular reason?
Look, you know, I've just closed out the last paper last night when I left the office, so I've done a lot. There's been a lot of stories, and I'll probably have a better idea in a couple of days' time when I get some good sleep. But you know, like I said, when somebody asked me yesterday, what will you remember? Look, I will remember telling the stories of those really poor and really unfortunate families who had nothing, no water, no electricity, and the house they live in will, you know, best be described as third world country shacks. We've been able to help those families get them better homes. We've been able to help them get them water tanks. We've been able to help them get them some food and maybe send their kids to school. Now that's the stuff that easily for me, you know, aside from the investigative nature of the job, aside from all the other stuff that we have to do as journalists, which is quite exciting. That's what we live for as journalists. But I think for me, on the personal level, at the end of the day, I will go back to those families and look at them, and the happiness is to see them live in a proper home and have water, and the kids able to go to school. We've been able to send off people to get medical treatment overseas, you know, through funding that's raised in stories that we've done. And I think that for me is easily the stuff I remember.
Well, Kenny, we can take this opportunity from everyone here at Pacific Beat to thank you for helping us out on so many occasions over the years while you've been editor of the Samoa Observer. Congratulations on a job well done. And, of course, we hope to speak to you again in the future, perhaps in a different guise.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you. And thank you as well. Thank you to your listeners and thank you to everyone, Richard. May you have an enjoyable last day of 2020 and all the best for 2021.
Same to you, Kenny. Happy New Year to you and everyone over there in Samoa. That's Mata'afa Kenny Lasar, who's no longer editor of the Samoa Observer, occupied the post since May 2006, but put out his final edition yesterday.
Wherever you are in the world, watch stories from home, anytime, with a new ABC Australia iView app. Never miss a moment of the programs you love.
From Four Corners.
Welcome to Landline.
London, America is back.
Hello and welcome to 7:30.
We are having that debate.
And the stories that matter.
We owe it to people to tell the real story, to bring people the truth.
Download the new ABC Australia iView app. Yours to explore, anywhere, anytime.
So why not check it out?
With Pacific Beat for New Year's Eve 2020 here on ABC Radio Australia. And in Papua New Guinea, Ariko Fufurefa is a survivor and a change maker. 17 years ago, she managed to escape an abusive husband and went on to found an organisation which has helped to change the conversation around women's rights in the highlands town of Goroka. Jordan Fennell has been speaking to Ariko, who is now featuring in a movie that highlights the experiences of marginalised women in PNG during COVID-19 lockdown.
During those years, we don't have respect in the community. That was during 2003. We don't have funding like now. Like, we got funding from other donors to educate our local women out in the communities, like settlement, the rural communities. We were not aware of our rights because during that time, people think that they own the women because of right price and the culture that we have in our country. That's why the organization have come up. And I'm also one of the survivor. For myself, I nearly killed by my husband. And I've gone through so many violence during the time. And through that, I just come out and I do a women organization.
It must have been quite tough, as you said. The culture back in 2003, I suppose, was quite different from today in dealing with how women were respected and how they were viewed, and yourself as a domestic violence survivor. What was it like to start this particular organization at a time when perhaps people didn't have the same understanding of the violence women face?
Because I think lack of information was reached to our local people out in the communities and our husbands. So even the law was not very tough to protect women and girls at that time. Once it was registered, we do a bit of cleaning surrounding our communities to get a bit of funding more to support the organization. And then also in those times, we were going out to the rural communities to educate women on HIV and women protection. But during the time, we didn't get any funding yet. That's why we really struggled to get some funding. So that's how we try our best to get funding to do other works as well, to train women to do life skills, like training women in cooking, baking, and then we also do sewing women Mary blouses and suits and something like that. So yeah, that's how we do our fundraising.
And what was the response from women in the community when you started this new organization?
It was like a new thing to them. And some of them agreed to join the group. Some of them were thinking that it was a mushroom group or something like that, something that they don't really understand. And we tried to get them through some trainings. From there, they learned something new. And then they changed their mindset. And some of them, they become our volunteers or support groups that they work very close with us to report women who are affected or who are in the remote areas, to bring them to access services in urban towns. And some of them were empowered, so they go out and they educate other women in the very remote areas about their rights and about gender. So that's how the women, this organization grew up.
What about the men in the community? How did they respond to this new organization?
Like before, in 2003, 2004, 5 and 6, we don't have respect by the men. They said, these women are not doing, what are they doing? They like to challenge us, the men, or what are they? They are under us. And then they said in Tok Pidgin, Mipla man, stop on top of, sleep on top of Mary. They mean that we sleep on top of women and they don't have power. So what are they talking about? We are the boss, so these are some of the challenges that we face, but we had never give up. But we try our very best to educate the men. So today, I'm respected by so many MPs and our local district administrators, and like the PPC in our provinces, I am respected. And I'm also in the decision making, and they respect some of the decision that I made. So, and at the moment, I'm the DDA for Hanganofi. It's the district that I come from.
And how does it feel to see that change over the past 17 years?
Oh, I was very happy thinking that I can change the men, not like before. I can change the men, and men can respect what I say, and they can involve me in decision making. That's it. I want that to be happen. And then we all work together. Also, I train the men to advocate to respect women and girls, and they go out in the field, they talk about respecting women and girls, so we all speak the same language.
Eriko, you have been featured in a new film this year called The Strong Pela Mary, where you speak about what it was like when Papua New Guinea went into its lockdown for coronavirus earlier this year. What was that time like for you?
During the lockdown, I see that women out in the communities, they have garden food, so they try their best to help them out in the village. But like accessing health services, it was very hard for the women to access health services and paralegal services. And then for me, in the communities, in the rural community settings, like in the settlements, they were afraid to go out to access other services. And they were really affected because they have not learned to have garden and food to provide for their families. That was a challenge. And then we see that our government don't have a plan for that emergency like COVID-19. So they were all over the place and we were all confused in that time.
And what did your organisation, the Cafe Settlers Women's Association, do in response to that?
Our organisation, we got funding from Oxfam, and we went out in the remote areas. And then also our district, our local MP also funded us. And our councillors, we all come together and we work together hand in hand. And then we go out in the remote areas to educate remote women and girls on their protection. And we talk about human rights. And also we talk about vulnerable groups of people out there, how to be protected, how to respond to their needs.
Featuring in this new film where you talk about all of this, what sort of impact are you hoping that the film will have on people who watch it?
It's like women are speaking on behalf of voiceless who cannot express their views to ex-support and also talks about protection for women to feel free to access services like medical livelihood and, livelihood activities.
For women back in Goroka and also around PNG who might look up to you and see you making these big moves in a world of men, do you have any message for them?
We all have to come together and like coalition. We must have a coalition to talk about what things is happening in other provinces. We have to come and discuss and then they can adopt some of the way of working and go back to their provinces to implement. And also we all need to support women to come for elections so we can have more women in parliament.
Absolutely. Indeed, any women in Parliament in Papua New Guinea would be a step forward right now. Erica Fufurefa, founder of the Cafe Urban Settlers Women's Association in the PNG Highlands, and she was speaking there to Jordan Fennell.
ABC Australia iView is a free video streaming service from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation for users around the world. The ABC Australia iView app is available for download on iOS and Android devices. ABC Australia iView has content that will keep you in touch with what is happening in Australia.
We simply want to say to you, Australia, thank you. Keep doing it. You're saving lives and you're saving livelihoods.
As well as comedy, entertainment, education and English language learning content. You can also stream the ABC News Channel live through your device using this app. So to watch great ABC programs like Four Corners Foreign Correspondent and Gardening Australia, download the ABC Australia iView app now.
Now, we were talking about women's rights in Papua New Guinea just there, and therefore an appropriate song to end the show and end the year on, really. This from the Black Sisters, the daughters of the West Papuan activist, the Black Brothers, with a track called Mama Pacifica.
Enough for a lifetime. The way you love, you care, can change your brother for a lifetime. If life's against you, girl, pick yourself up, baby, readjust your crown. The pain you feel will heal. You got the strength, girl. Walk away, now don't look back. You got to spread your wings and fly.
We got to stand up and rise up, Mama Pacifica. We got to stand tall.
Black Sisters, Mama Pacifica, they're daughters of West Papuan activists, the Black Brothers, and West Papuan activism, I'm sure, is a topic we'll come back to in 2021, as well as women's rights, of course, here on Pacific Beat, two of the big topics we've covered throughout the year. And this is it for 2020 as far as Pacific Beat is concerned. Big thanks to everyone who's been involved in the programme throughout the year. We are a small but perfectly formed unit, and we do our absolute best to bring you coverage of everything that's happening around the Pacific, certainly everything of significance. significance. We wish you well for this New Year's Eve and hope that 2021 brings you good things. And let's hope it turns out to be COVID-free for all of us. That would be quite something, wouldn't it? It's been a remarkable year, not just for the Pacific, but for the world as a whole. We'll have a special programme for you on New Year's Day tomorrow. Look back at some of the stories that have struck a chord with the reporters over the years, and we'll also chat to Evan Marsuka in Solomon Islands and to Hilda Wayne from our One Top programme about the stories that have stood out for them during 2020. I'm Richard Hewitt. Thanks for your company throughout the year. See you again in 2021.